This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Diplomats from all over the world are returning home after a hard-won agreement in Durban, South Africa. They agreed to do nothing to save our climate from disaster. Our governments will talk until 2015, and then maybe do something serious about greenhouse gas emissions in 2020, 8 years from now. By then, as Radio EcoShock listeners know, we will be committed to at least 3.5 degrees centigrade hotter world in 2100 than our ancestors knew in 1750. It will only get hotter after that. We're going to hear 4 reports. From India, journalist, author, and political analyst Prefal Bidway tells Stephen Leahy of IPS, a failure in Durban would be better than what we got. We go outside the spin of Western media. Then to San Francisco to hear NASA's Dr. James Hansen at the annual meeting of the American Geophysical Union. He describes our unique and dangerous path. Back to South Africa, where Janet Redman has survived the grueling Durban conference sessions to give us the wrap-up. What did and did not happen, along with the American role. We finish up with an interview by Dr. Michael Ropak from Australia's National Science Agency. He's part of the Global Carbon Project, which just published the bad news about our monstrous increase in emissions. New science, predictions of doom, and a world in paralysis. It's another Radio EcoShock show. At the Durban COP17 climate conference, India was blamed for not going along with the game. We're going to hear from Prefal Bidway, the author of The Politics of Climate Change and the Global Crisis. Prefal was interviewed by Stephen Leahy of the Independent Press Service on Friday, December 9th. The meeting was not over, but everything in the interview stands. Here is Prefal Bidway introducing himself.
I'm Prefal Bidway. I'm a columnist, a political commentator, social science researcher, and an activist on environmental peace and justice issues. I am a fellow of the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam, which is an international fellowship of scholar activists, and I've just published a book called The Politics of Climate Change and the Global Crisis, Mortgaging Our Future. This is the international edition is published by the Transnational Institute.
We're here on the last day and the last hours of COP17. What's your assessment of the negotiations so far?
The picture is still not clear, but if the texts that have been put out on the Kyoto Protocol and on what is called the Indaba text on the long-term cooperative action working group are anything to go by, then I think this COP has been a failure, a disastrous failure, for a number of reasons. One, instead of taking the simple, direct, and honest route of amending the Kyoto Protocol so as to give it a second commitment period, second effective legally binding phase, because the first one ends next year, it has postponed the decision to next year, to COP18. It has also not even hinted at any higher targets, more ambitious targets, for the Kyoto Protocol to be decided by the developed countries. It has moved away from the original formulation of a legally binding agreement to a new legal framework, presumably to suit the United States. And so this is a departure from the European Union text, which talked of a legally binding agreement for all. But that is where I think the biggest problem lies, which is that this text completely demolishes the polluter pays principle and the foundation, one of the foundational tenets of the climate convention, which is the CBDR. Common but differentiated responsibilities, because it recommends a new legal framework for all, including developed and developing countries, when we know, it's been scientifically established that the responsibility of the developed countries for climate change is far, far greater than that of the developing countries, that about 3/4 of all accumulated emissions in the atmosphere originate from the developed countries. So they have to do much more. They have to do it first, and they have to do it in proportion to their responsibility for causing climate change. All this has now been destroyed, and what you undermined and what you now have is the idea of a new agreement, which will be in force certainly by 2020, if not earlier, which inverts the principle of climate responsibility and transfers the burden to the developing countries, which is a very retrograde move indeed.
So what does this tell us about the politics of climate change?
What it tells us is that we are still in a situation where might is right, where the powerful call the shots, where the weak can be cajoled, coerced, bribed, threatened, and bullied into submission. We've been seeing this process right since the Bali Action Plan, the Bali Climate Conference of 2007, when the developing countries made their last effort to create a roadmap that would actually contain elements of equity, ambition, and fairness and effectiveness in the climate agreement. All of those have been now rolled back. It started with Copenhagen was the first big blow, because it meant that the world moved away from emissions reductions obligations based upon science and equity to pledge and review, voluntary, arbitrary, and mostly paltry targets through pledges, voluntary pledges by individual countries. Since Copenhagen, over the last 2 years, the big powers of the North, developed countries, coerced the developing countries into making emissions reduction pledges which are much higher than their own. They're 30% to 300% higher, depending on how you count them. Secondly, they introduced huge ambivalences and loopholes in their own pledges, although they're the biggest emitters in the world, and as I said, historically responsible for 3/4 of all emissions. These loopholes are so big that one analysis shows that if all of the loopholes are exploited, then the sum total of emissions reductions, you know, which are averted, exceeds the emissions reduction pledges that have been made, you know.
When you say the big countries, you mean the U.S.,
the European Union, Japan, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and also some of the Central European countries. So this is extremely sad. The fact is that the emission reductions pledges bear no relationship to what the world needs in order to stabilize the climate, in order that global warming does not exceed 2 degrees, which is the maximum science tells us that planet Earth can bear. In fact, many scientists now believe that 2 degrees is far too high. It should be 1.5 degrees. And so this guarantees a temperature, a global warming of the order of 3, 4, even 5 degrees. And what that means, Stephen, is really utterly frightening. And, you know, at 3 degrees, you will cross a number of tipping points beyond which remedial action becomes futile. And at 4 degrees, according to Britain's best-known climate scientist, Kevin Anderson, only a tenth of the world's population will survive. That's the kind of devastation we're talking about. You know, with sea levels rising by 5 meters, 7 meters, you know, absolutely inundating and drowning out whole continents and whole nations. And
so how do we get out of this box? Would it be better if these negotiations collapse?
I agree. I would like to see absolutely no agreement, zero agreement, rather than a bad agreement, which is then passed off as something positive, something cooperative, something that builds confidence and gives hope and so on and so on. That is greenwash, you know, greenwash, not whitewash. That's what happened in Copenhagen. That's what happened in Cancun. This is what seems to be happening in Durban too, except that now there's so little time left. If global emissions do not peak by 2020, we are fried. There's just a very tiny, small little window of opportunity left. And yet, according to the text that's being circulated, it's not until 2020 that a new agreement will take effect. So nothing much is going to happen between now and 2020, which is precisely when we need to act.
I have asked scientists and others who say they have briefed all the delegates in the countries, and they tell me that the delegates and the countries understand the science. They're not disputing the science. Mm-hmm. So why are they acting as if the science doesn't matter?
Out of political compulsion, out of the weakness of some of the smaller countries such as AOSIS, Alliance of Small Island States, and the least developed countries, they're very vulnerable. From what I can hear in the corridors here and elsewhere, they were told by powerful countries of the like the United States and the European Union states, look, we will help you with adaptation. All you need is money. You don't have the technology. You don't know how to do it. We'll do it for you. Take the money and keep quiet. Otherwise, you're going to get no money from us. So it's this kind of crude bullying and bribery that actually induced many of them to. And we now know that Gambia and Denmark brokered a deal between the least developed countries and the EU to make this whole new unholy alliance possible. And
between the European Union and
the LDCs and AOCs.
Okay. So AOCs. These smaller, weaker states are aligned now with the European Union.
Yeah. In effect, what has happened is that the European Union actually shifted the goalposts. Before Durban, its stated position was that it is completely and unconditionally committed to a second commitment period for Kyoto, to greater ambition on the part of everybody. It said that its own unilateral commitment is for a 20% reduction in emissions by 2020, even if there is no agreement in the world. But it would raise this cut to 30% if there is a good agreement. Now it's resiling from all of that, and it made, a bit just before Durban, made support for a second commitment period for Kyoto conditional upon a new global binding agreement which involves all the countries barring the LDCs, the AOCs. Basically, I think the target was the larger emerging economies, and it wanted them to accept the same obligations as the developed countries. In my view, this actually is in principle wrong, and the EU knew that this was going to be unacceptable to the basic countries. And it still, you know, did that in order to create a new scapegoat. And that's basic, and particularly China and India. Because the EU itself has not done what it promised to do, even in respect of the Kyoto Protocol. Leading states of the EU, like France, Italy, and the Netherlands, are missing their Kyoto targets, in spite of the fact that they have the advantage of hiding behind the contracting economies of the former Eastern Bloc.
They have all that extra hot air
pumps. Plus, they're buying carbon offsets cheap, extremely cheap, from both the Eastern European countries and from developing countries.
They've also outsourced a lot of their dirty industries. For instance, I know some steel companies are in the U.S. now that used to be in Europe.
Yeah. Now, this shows a degree of, I think, disingenuousness and lack of commitment to meeting their own obligations, their own solemnly made promises, and their legal requirements. The European Union has therefore acted, in my view, in bad faith. And the basic states, too, it would be wrong if they joined hands with the United States, just as they did in Copenhagen. In fact, the Copenhagen Accord, which was a massive setback to the cause of climate stabilization, was, as you know, negotiated between just five countries, the United States and the four basic nations. Now, if they repeat Copenhagen, I mean, that would fulfill my worst nightmare, you know. But in effect, if the now the new text that has emerged is only slightly less worse, because it actually accommodates the demand of the United States that there be no legally binding agreement. And it talks of a new legal framework, which is a very vague concept. I'm sure that there'll be a kind of side deal to say, look, you guys are benefiting from CDM projects, Clean Development Mechanism projects, whereby you earn carbon credits on the cheap, and you are the, between the four of you, you have the largest, some 90% or 85% of all CDM projects and CDM credits. We will expand the CDM, so you can have more money. But, you know, the CDM is a hoax, and it's not brought about any carbon reductions. There are enough studies to show...
It's transferred money, but it hasn't
brought about, yeah, exactly, abatement of emissions, or promoted clean technology, low carbon.
But in the real politic world,
it is possible that the U.S. cannot say they agree to a legally binding anything in an election year for a president who's going to have a tough fight.
Mm-hmm.
Because it can be spun by the opposition as committing the America to...
No, that's always been the case. The United States has exploited this time and again. It pushed other countries into ratifying the Kyoto Protocol. It even sent Al Gore to convince the Japanese that they must ratify it, and then they didn't ratify it themselves. So they are bending the whole climate negotiations process to suit their aims, and on the false premise, the illusion that the U.S. would one day come on board and behave like a responsible nation rather than a rogue nation. And that's never happened. It's no closer. And it always will oppose legally binding commitments. In fact, in the negotiations, Chinese delegate privately asked an American delegate, are there any conditions? For instance, if we accept binding commitments, would you be prepared to do that? He said, no, we don't. Not this year, not ever. You know, so this kind of, the European Union is very soft on the U.S. for historical reasons connected with the Cold War alliance and stuff like that. And so it doesn't call the U.S. to account. Rather, it indulges it and says, oh, you know, we understand President Obama's difficulties, he can't do it in Lake Shadia. But actually, in reality, it doesn't work like that. So it's a very tragic thing. And as I argue in my book, we've seen a constant degeneration, at least since 2007, and this is the lowest point that the climate negotiations process has reached. I mean, you know, it's important to remind ourselves that 20 years ago, the developed countries agreed and offered to have their emissions peak by the year 2000. And they're still growing 11 years on. So, you know, they've betrayed their own commitments and played dirty. They've cheated the world, and the world hasn't resisted enough.
Yeah, I think the emissions have grown.
It grew 6% last year.
6%, I think, overall, 50% amongst the developing countries since Kyoto was signed.
Mm. Oh, this is very bad news indeed. And I also want to say that I argue in my book that the basic countries cannot pretend forever to be part of the developing world as if they belong to the same category as the LDCs. They have to accept obligations.
The basic countries are developed countries.
They're not developed, really. I mean, come on, in my country, 500 million people don't have electricity. I mean, you know, the economy may be growing fast, but all the growth is going into the pockets of the top 10-15% of the population. The bulk of the poor have just not improved their standard of living. So we have a long agenda. China is in a different league altogether. Even Brazil is not that desperately poor, nor is South Africa, although South African disparities are probably as bad as India's. But we have a long way to go. I'm not saying that way can only be fulfilled through rising emissions. You have technologies, you have renewables, where you can ensure access to modern energy sources like electricity without raising emissions proportionately. But India and China already offered to reduce the emissions intensity of their production, the amount of carbon necessary per unit of production, by 20-25% in the case of India, and 40-45% in the case of China. Now, they could say, we are prepared to make this voluntary offer into a binding commitment. And at a later stage, we can accept even emissions reductions. We can negotiate that. But by saying that just developing countries, you know, they're not convincing anyone, including the LDCs. Because the China of today is very different from China of 1992. Let's face it. I mean, it's a huge... emissions have grown 8 times. It's overtook the United States 3 years ago as the largest emitter of the world. It's really a huge industrial power. So you need actually 3 categories, right? You have the developed countries, you have at the other end the least developed and the very, very poor, vulnerable island states. And in between, you have countries like BASIC, which have reached a certain level of emissions growth and economic growth, and they must have different sets of obligations.
Okay, so what's the way forward here? I mean, we're in a mess and going nowhere fast, so what's the way out of this?
Well, I think this agreement should be blocked. That's the only way. These two documents must not be allowed to pass by the COP.
And then
say, okay, this is a failure, and we start all over again, and we, if necessary, have a COP 17 bis or whatever. But don't let this pass. And I think if it does, then we are really doomed.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, Praful.
That was Praful Bidway, Indian journalist and author of The Politics of Climate Change and the Global Crisis. Find out more at prafulbidway.org, spelled PRAFULBIDWAI. Stephen Leahy immediately sent this interview to Radio EcoShock. Stephen is one of the few all-out environmental journalists left anywhere. He needs your support to keep covering the world. I'm asking you to make a donation at his website, stephenleahy.net. StephenLeahy.net, or find that link in my blog at ecoshock.info. Help keep him going. As the Durban Climate Conference was meeting, on the other side of the world, in San Francisco, the American Geophysical Union was holding its annual conference. Some of the most important climate science of the year is presented and reported there. We have only time to give you a brief excerpt from an hour-long press briefing on December 6, 2011. It was a panel discussion between 3 of the leading lights. I'm going to focus on a few clips from NASA's Dr. James Hansen, plus a bit from Elko Rowling, Professor of Ocean and Climate Change at Southampton University in the UK. By the way, you will hear this antiquated tape rewind sound between clips.
Welcome to our 11 a.m. press conference. which we're calling the Paleoclimate Record Points to Potential Rapid Climate Changes. We have three speakers: James Hansen, Director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York City; Elko Rolling, Professor of Ocean and Climate Change at Southampton University in Southampton in the United Kingdom; and our third speaker is Ken Caldera, Senior Scientist, Department of Global Ecology at the Carnegie Institution of Washington at Stanford University in Stanford, California.
Steve Connor from The Independent. It's a question for Jim Hansen. The Global Climate Project, I think, recently published some results in Nature saying that we're now back on course for increasing CO2 emissions, not just increasing CO2 emissions, but accelerating increasing CO2 emissions. I think something like 10 billion tons released in 2010 after the dip in 29. Given the fact that Durban is now taking place, how long can we go on like this, do you think, before it really becomes too late to do anything?
Well, you said, and how long can these emissions continue to increase rapidly until it would become too late to do anything? Well, to do anything, of course, at any time when you begin to decrease the emissions, that will have some effect. However, what the paleoclimate record tells us is that the dangerous level of global warming is less than what we thought a few years ago. It was natural to think that warming of a few degrees didn't sound so bad. But when we look at the paleoclimate record, we see that, just going back to the Pliocene, although the poles were a lot warmer then, the global mean temperature wasn't that much warmer. So we can't, the target that has been talked about in international negotiations of 2 degrees Celsius for global warming is actually a prescription for long-term disaster. We can't say exactly what long-term is, but we're beginning to see signs of slow feedbacks beginning to come into play already. The ice sheets are beginning to lose mass at a significant rate. Even methane hydrates are to some degree beginning to bubble out of melting permafrost. So what I will show in a paper that I'm not presenting at this conference, but will, with a number of co-authors, including Elko, be trying to finish up in the next month or so, is a reaffirmation of a conclusion that we made a couple of years ago, that we really should be aiming to keep CO2 no higher than about 350 parts per million, and possibly somewhat less than that, if we want to keep the climate similar, not too different than the Holocene. And that is probably necessary if we want to maintain stable ice sheets and stable shorelines and avoid many other issues that we did not try to go into today. So if that's the goal, to stay at, to get the CO2 down to 350 ppm within a century or so, that would require, we started today, and if we assume that reforestation could take up 100 gigatons of CO2, that would be essentially going back to the pre-deforestation levels, then we would have to reduce CO2 emissions at 6% per year beginning if we began next year. If we'd began in 5 years ago, then it would have been 3% per year. And if we wait till 2020, it becomes 15% per year. So if we're hoping to maintain a climate, a planet that looks like the one that humanity has known, then we're basically out of time right now. We've got to start to reduce emissions. And so this continued rapid growth makes it exceedingly difficult. We've got to turn that around. It's scientifically clear. At what point are we committed to an ice-free world? The study that we did in 2008 estimated that in coming down from the ice-free world to an ice sheet on Antarctica, which occurred 34 million years ago, we estimated that that transition occurred at a CO2 level of about 500 ppm. Now, some other studies, in fact, I think actually the best fit was 450 ppm. Some other studies have estimated larger numbers, but usually those involve a model. And, you know, ice sheet models, unfortunately, as yet we don't have good ice sheet models that will put in all the physics that's needed. It's a very hard problem because it depends upon ice shelves around the ice sheets. When those melt, then the ice sheets become more active and their ice streams discharge ice more rapidly. And there's also the issue about hysteresis. Do you go, if you're going backward, do you need to have a higher level of CO2 to reach the point where you lose the ice sheet? So it's a very hard question to answer, but the equilibrium response, as Elko showed, if you doubled CO2, which practically all governments and seem to be assuming that we're going to do that and they act as if it's okay, that would eventually get us to the ice-free state. So we really can't do that. But that has not yet sunk in to policymakers' head. I think Elko should try to clarify what I just said.
I hate it when that happens. The biggest problem is to project from what we are looking at is a cooling climate over time, and to project that forward into a warming climate, because the presence of a large ice sheet keeps the planet there locally quite cold. So they tend to preserve themselves to some extent. This is similar to when you switch off your freezer and then you can just wait a couple of hours and nothing happens, and then as it starts to melt, suddenly it will go very quickly. So that's what Jim means with the hysteresis. You have to give the system a bigger kick to melt that ice than that you have to push it to actually start to form that ice. How severe that hysteresis is completely open to question. What I showed, where we're going to 25 meters above the present, we are looking at the fast ice there. That is not the East Antarctic, the main body of the East Antarctic ice sheet. If that goes as well, then sea level will go up to 60, 70 meters above the present. So what I was looking at is the ice that probably doesn't need so much kicking, and that's where, you know, the sort of numbers that Jim was saying do apply. You know, a doubling of CO2 would be really bad news if you sustain that for a good couple of centuries. To really remove also East Antarctica, to pump sea level up to about 60 or 70 meters above the present, we probably have to do something much closer to, you know, another doubling, I would have guessed, because that ice sheet tends to preserve itself quite efficiently.
And maybe 25 meters is enough that it really doesn't matter. Whether it's 25 or 65,
yeah,
doesn't really matter.
You've just heard clips from Dr. James Hansen and Professor Elko Rolling at the American Geophysical Union meeting in San Francisco, December 6, 2011. Find a lot more at www.agu.org. You can see that entire one-hour press briefing with Dr. Ken Caldera as well on YouTube. Find a link in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. We'll be right back in just a minute with more Radio EcoShock.